Well, if you see on your program, we're going to be treated with a subject from Philippians 4:12, broken into two parts, two speakers. Brother Len will start off talking about I know how to be abased, and followed by Jonathan Freer, the how to abound section. So, without further ado, Brother Len Grice on how to be abased.
Well, brethren, again, it is indeed a pleasure to be here with you and a real blessing in this convention so far. And many thanks to all those who serve. Special thanks to John and Becky Carney for picking us up at the airport on Friday night, staying with them up here and providing for our transportation back. But it has been a blessing to you. Unfortunately, I have to go back tomorrow, so I can't even have luxury of what Jerry has in flying a red eye. I've got to get back so I can be at work first thing on Tuesday morning. But it has been a real blessing to be here with you, brethren. We look forward to continued sessions today. Before I start this, I had to have a picture here for Brad. That's my dog. How to be abased. Philippians 4:12 is the scripture that the convention committee has selected for this discussion. I know both how to be abased and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I am instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. The New International Version reads, and I want to try to get clear on what this means, this term surrounding to be abased. New International reads this way: I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. Now, the New American Standard, I like, gets closer to what I think Paul is conveying to us here when we look at the context of this particular item. New American Standard says, I know how to get along with humble means, and I also know how to live in prosperity. But the humble means is what I think he's getting closer to. And I think the context that we have from verses 10 to 14 of this chapter puts us closer to what this translation in New American Standard uses as humble means. Let's look at this context of 10 to 14, where he says, But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last you have revived your concern for me. Remember, he's talking to Philippians, brethren. It's a church that he had great admiration for, didn't criticize them at all. But Paul was in need, and they had sent to him a messenger, Epaphroditus, with a message not just of hope and care, but also funds to help him while he was in prison. And Paul wrote a letter to them to tell them how grateful he was. So he's saying, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at last you have revived your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, and I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. So I think as we look at the words there, he said suffering need, going hungry, humble means, I think all seem to indicate that Paul was talking about his physical circumstances, that he had the ability, because of his faith and strength and the learning that he'd had from the Lord, is a very important part of his training to be able to adapt to those circumstances that he was in. If we look at the word that's used here for a base, it's Strong's 5013, tapanoo, is the way Strong's instructs us to pronounce that word. And it means to depress, figuratively to humiliate. But notice, in a condition of heart, All right? Not to, like we would think of, humiliating someone in front of their peers or in front of someone else by screaming at them. It's really humiliation in the condition of heart. So to prepare him to understand the Lord's bounty. And the words used, to abase, to bring lower, to humble, which is again some of the translation that we saw there. And let's look at some other places where this word is used. I think it helps us understand the context in which Paul is addressing and talking to the Philippian brethren here. It's used in Matthew 18:4. Jesus here is talking. Remember, the little children came to him, and all the apostles wanted him to turn them away. And he said, no, have them come to me. And he used that as a lesson. He said, therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Now, there's a lot of lessons about how children humble themselves, but I think he was saying they were eager to learn. You know, children, as we've talked about already here, I think children are very eager to learn. They were attentive. They were ready to understand the lessons. And Jesus used that as an example of humility. Just as that young child is ready to learn, we should be ready to learn. It's used again in 1 Peter 5:6. Perhaps this is a much more familiar one that we use a lot. And I remember the booming voices of some of the old fellows in the truth movement. I'm trying to think who it was that used to talk, this had this scripture. And I think it was Brother Zano. If you remember Brother Zano, he was in the Midwest where I grew up. And he used to say, humble yourselves, therefore, under God's mighty hand, that he may lift you up. But that's the important lesson here. This isn't a purpose for humiliation. The purpose of this is to give you lessons so that you'll be prepared to be exalted. And I think, as we'll hear in the second part, that's a very important part of then being brought up. So again, the idea of humility. And Brad talked about humility in that character study book. Incidentally, we were a little bit ahead. We're now on knowledge, but that is a very valuable study tool. And that section on humility, I thought was very good. In fact, I reread it all in preparation for this because I think it does convey the lessons. But that's really what God is trying to teach us here. The lessons of abasement, of learning to live without everything perhaps we think we need, is sometimes a very important part of our training. On the other hand, as we hear, God uses those to prepare our spiritual heart to welcome him. So remember the circumstances Paul's in here. Paul's in prison at this point. You know, he really has spent a long time sort of toiling. This is Rembrandt's rendering of Paul. I'm not sure he looked like that. Paul was probably about 56 years old at the time. Jonathan, oh, you're 57, right?
No.
Oh, okay. So he probably looked more like Jonathan does. But here it makes him a little older. But Paul had really not much hope in front of him. He really didn't know whether he was going to be allowed to do his work or not. And he was kept in his home as a prisoner. But, you know, he had a lot of chores. As a prisoner, you didn't get everything provided to you. You still had to do everything yourself. He had to shop. He had to cook. He had to transcribe the letters. And he really didn't have, because he was in his home, any means to do that. It wasn't as though he could go and work as a tent maker, as he did some of the time. So he had no money or means. And the Philippian brethren, as we read in that book, send a gift to him of money. And they send it through, as I said, the messenger Epaphroditus. And Epaphroditus then stays there and helps Paul with his everyday work. You know, it's a wonderful lesson in humility from Epaphroditus, my brethren. Sometimes we think of Timothy as Paul's great assistant. And Timothy did. He went out and he spoke to everyone. And he represented Paul in the evangelical field. But Epaphroditus, if you read Paul's tender remarks about him in the book of Philippians, you'll see that Paul treasured him just as much. And he was eager to send Epaphroditus back so they could know he was well. But that was a very precious thing that Paul had. So they furnished funds to Paul and helped through this personal messenger. And Paul learned in this, and he was grateful and was expressing his gratitude to them and recognizing that, you know, self-sufficiency is not always possible. You know, brethren, it's really, sometimes we're very eager to show that we can stand on our own. sometimes when you have young kids, you're very eager to have them learn that they can stand on their own. But I think all of us get to a point where if we have been in a case of being self-sufficient and suddenly find ourselves with the loss of a job, with circumstances of sickness, it's very hard to allow someone else to do that for you. We always talk about it's a great lesson for us to allow others to serve us, because I think that's the lesson that Paul is drawing here. I'm drawing lessons in the fact that I know when I don't have something that I can live through you in these humble means. So Paul was learning this as a very important part of his lesson. Ecclesiastes 5:11 reads, "When goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good is there to the owners thereof, save in the beholding of them with their eyes?" Brethren, here's a Roomba vacuum. I don't know how many of you have one of those. Actually, know some brethren do. $249 for a Roomba vacuum that will go around your thing. And I just saw last week there's a new one came out that's the deluxe model. It's about $350, but it actually does a much better job of going back and forth across your walk. Here's a pound of Kopi Luwak coffee beans. Now, I like coffee, and we're in Seattle, the coffee capital of the world. And at Starbucks, at $350 a pop is expensive. What about $298 for a pound of coffee beans? Is that a necessity? Well, for some, yes, maybe it is. Here's something I asked Gretchen to get me for my birthday. This is a Briani cashmere hemming bone robe. It's just a little under $5,000. Now, that's one you'd want to wear outside of your bedroom, I think, because of its attractiveness. Okay, here's a clutch purse. Now, you know what I've been building up. This is what Gretchen asked for her birthday. Anybody want to put a price on that? How much?
No, like
6,000.
6,000.
Ah, way off. That was Alana Marks, Cleopatra bag, $100,000. Now, the problem, if you bought this bag, you wouldn't have any money left to put in it. But I think it sort of gives us an idea of what Solomon was after when he made that statement. He said, you know, goods, worldly goods, earthly goods, what we have, does not ensure our contentment. People keep after things and keep after things, and that's not what provides us things. We need to learn to be content, even in dire circumstances. And it's not just those earthly goods that are going to give us that satisfaction. This is in Greece. If you've been to Greece, Corfu, this is a shrine of St. Arsenius. And Arsenius was Arsenius lived in the 5th century. And he abandoned Egyptian society and went to live in the desert. And this particular part, even though he lived in Egypt, was put up as sort of a memorial for him. But he would often visit Alexandria in Egypt, and he would wander through all the bazaars. And, you know, Egypt was famous. If you've ever been to a flea market, you know what a flea market, all things. Well, Egypt had one of the world's greatest flea markets in Alexandria. And he would often come down and wander from the desert through there. And they would ask him, you know, you're living up there in the hills and in the desert. Why do you come down here and go through the bazaar? And his point was, he'd say, "My heart rejoices in all the things I don't need." Brethren, that should be our attitude. You know, there's a constant battle in our life, and just from, especially in our country, the constant battle against seductive materialism. You know, it's amazing the number of things we could buy and we could spend our time and money on. And so there is a usefulness, and I think Paul's pointing out to us the usefulness of walking through society and sort of looking at all the things that we are content to get along without. And I think that's what Paul's getting at. It's not to be in dire need, but to rejoice in the fact that God is shaping our hearts, learning us lessons, and it's not always about what we have. 1 Timothy 6, 6-8, he makes a statement about this, and he says, "But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. Having food and raiment, let us therewith be content. Now, not too many of us would be happy with just food and raiment, but I think the principle that Paul is putting forth here is our priorities need to be straight. Our priorities need to be set on the things above, not on the things that we have. And I think that's why Paul's saying, I know how to be abased. If I have nothing, I'm perfectly content in the Lord to have nothing because I know I still have Him. He is still in my heart. Remember, that word was mainly a humbling or a humiliation of the heart. It was dealing with the spiritual aspect. That's the lesson. It wasn't to make you squander or a beggar, but it was to provide that spiritual lesson. Everything we accomplish, how much we own, who we are, who we know, is really useless, I think Paul is telling us, unless we have the peace and contentment that's provided to us in the Lord's service. You know, and there's a lot of humbling experiences, brethren. Paul had one here in prison, and he had many more we can read about in many of his writings. And think back yourself. We've had several speakers talk about some of their personal experiences and how they shaped them for the things that came later in their life. And for us, the important thing is the Lord is humiliating our heart for a reason. It's to get rid of that focus on self and let us focus outward on the fact that, as we heard earlier, we are to be one of many in a body. Those humbling experiences are shaping us for our own place amongst the 144,001. Anyone recognize this person? Leonard Bernstein, one of the famous conductors of the world. And you know, a lot of orchestras he conducted. And Bernstein also conducted in our own area, Philadelphia Orchestra at one time and New York Orchestra. But Bernstein had a lot of admirers, and I think maybe you admire him. I thought he was a great conductor, a great songwriter. And Bernstein had said, someone had asked him, Professor Bernstein, what is the hardest instrument in the orchestra to play? What do you think he said? He said, the second fiddle. He said, you know, I can always get plenty of first violinists, but to find one who plays the second violin with as much enthusiasm, or the second French horn, or the second flute, now that's a problem. And yet, if no one plays second, we have no harmony. Brethren, that's the lesson the Lord is trying to give us. Our life needs to be a harmony with all the others. You know, those serve who also stand and wait. But I think those experiences we have that Paul is giving us and telling us about in his own situation were those things that shaped him to realize that he was one of many in the body. And even though he was an apostle, yet the things he learned, just like Jesus learned, obedience by the things he suffered, Paul said in that abasement, he would learn just as well. So what is true humility? You know, sometimes we talk about humility, and again, in studying the things we did in the chapters on humility in the character book, I think we find that it's not a case of being weak, it's not the case of vacillating, but it's a case of having a focus. It's a case of having a desire, of having a determination, of having a dedication. Those three D's are very necessary for us to focus on what we have to do, and that's to be part of the Lord's service. And many times involves whatever comes our way, those are the things we would do. Just as Jesus washed the feet of his disciples and his apostles, so with us. Everything we do, and that's Paul's lesson here, everything we do is to be secondary to winning that prize of the high calling in Jesus. So it doesn't matter what you have, what you know, what you are. Everything you have in your life must be suppressed to focus on that, or must be secondary to focusing on what you're trying to accomplish. And it's a recognition that the only true meaning in our life comes from actually playing that second fiddle in the orchestra. Are you willing to stand behind Jesus, follow Him, and allow Him to direct your life? and allow the Lord to direct your life and be content in whatever circumstance that the Lord puts you in. And recognize that there's nothing, I think there's nothing in your life that happens that the Lord doesn't overrule once you've committed to Him. You know, it's sometimes you get upset because you get held up in traffic, or you know, you say, "Ah, I've got this flat tire. What am I supposed to do?" Brethren, I think when we're done, and if we make our calling election sure, and first thing we do is on the other side of the veil meet our guardian angel, and perhaps some of us, sometimes the guardian angel may come up to us and say, "Do you know what a lot of trouble you were?" But I think we'll learn all those circumstances where we were abased, those circumstances where we were put in difficult circumstances were for the benefit of our protection. I think Jerry keyed in on it this morning when he talked about how God holds you in the palm of His hand. If you have a flat tire, you get stuck in traffic, don't get mad, because maybe that's the Lord's way of preventing you, holding you back from getting into a bad accident somewhere down the road. Just remember that, you know, everything we do, if we're in that role of playing second fiddle, we have that in our fixed mind to realize that God is directing our paths. We see many examples of that in the Scriptures. You know, the nation of Israel, they were first enslaved for 400 years, severely suppressed. And it says they cried out to the Lord. In 400 years they cried out. And the Lord finally recognized them. He finally delivered them. And what did He do? He exalted them to a favored status so that they gained the land and never would be taken away. He made a covenant with them, that law covenant that exists today and will be replaced at one day by the new covenant when they will again play that prominent role in the earth. But remember, first they were enslaved for that 400 years. Moses was driven out of Egypt in fear. He was disgraced. But he received, remember what happened to Moses? Moses received the law from the hand of God. Can you imagine that, brethren? Getting something from the hand of God? He became Israel's greatest ancestor to this day, besides Abraham. Moses is the only one they look at because they say Moses is the only one that talked face to face with God. Paul was blinded. He was plagued all these years with the thorn in the flesh. But it was Paul that became the instrument to carry that message to you and me. As we heard earlier, the dogs. We receive that message through Paul. Joshua said, "Choose," in 24:15, "choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve." Brethren, you cannot give up your will. We're talking about giving up your will to the Lord. You must exercise your will. You must will to obey. You must will to give up your will. There's never a question of what God will do. God will do everything for you. If you have that full assurance of faith, that means God gives you everything you need. The only question is, what will I do? How will I react? Our choice, brother, must be a deliberate one. We must have that determination. Not just something that we drift into. We must focus on it and make it part of our lives. And I think the supreme example we have of this word, tapanoho, is found in Philippians 2:8. The word, it's about Jesus, when it says, "And being found in the appearance as a man, He humbled Himself and became obedient to death." Think about it. Jesus, in His pre-human existence, was the highest perceptible being in the universe. No one could talk to God. Moses didn't talk to God. He talked to His representative. The highest perceptible being in the universe. And where did He end up? He ended up in a death on the cross, the transgressor that everybody spit on, and He was the dregs of humanity. That's the humility. That's the lesson that God is giving to us so that we can be part of that 144,001. That's the word that Paul uses in this example in Philippians. And he says in Ephesians 4:2, "Walk in a manner worthy of your calling with which you have been called, with all humility." You know, in the Greek culture, humility wasn't a virtue, it was a vice. It was only the slaves that practiced humility. Everyone else, you know, took advantage of everyone. But for us, it's just the opposite. our acceptance of Jesus and the recognition of being put in that training program means we take that role. In Matthew 16:26, Young's literal translation reads, "For what is a man profited if he may gain the whole world, but of his life suffer loss? Or what shall a man give as an exchange for his life?" I think Jesus is telling us, brethren, this world's goods are flitting. It's the real things that we put in our heart, the treasures that God gives us, that are important for life. You know, when our heart stops beating, all the things that we've had, it doesn't matter if you're one of the Lord's or not. You can work hard for the big cars, the lavish homes, big vacations, expensive bank accounts. Really don't mean much once you're gone. What really matters to us as the consecrated Christian is how we've represented the Lord in all of our actions. So, brethren, in wrapping this up, how do we guarantee that we can rejoice in abased circumstances? Now, I've handed out some scriptures. I don't know who I gave them to, so I have to trust you. And as I come to these, I'm going to ask you to stand and read that scripture that I gave you. And these are the 9 things I think we can do to solidify our place as having being able to assure that we will learn those lessons of humility and abasement. Proverbs 3:9-10.
Honor the Lord with thy substance and with the first fruits of thine increase. So shall thy barn be filled with plenty, and thy presses shall burst out with new wine.
Now, I think this scripture tells us we need to transfer our ownership to God. All that we have becomes His if we remember Him and put Him as the priority in our life. Romans 13:8.
Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For he who loves his fellow man has fulfilled the law.
Brethren, we need to get out of debt. And that's money debt, certainly, but also all the debts that we owe. If what we owe exceeds what we have, we must exercise self-discipline to reverse that situation. You know, and if we come to the thing where we're borrowing so much in our own life to have those things we want, we're entering a bondage that's very difficult for us to get out of mentally, let alone physically. Matthew 6:31-32. Brethren, we just need to accept God's direction in our life. Worry over what we don't have, lack of money, or other things will disappear if we really believe that God cares for all of our needs. 1 Peter 4:11.
May I be? 1 Peter 4:11. If anyone speaks, he should do it as one speaking in the very words of God. If anyone serves, he should do it with the strength God provides, so that in all things God may be praised through Jesus Christ, to whom be the glory and the power forever and ever. Amen.
Brethren, we need to focus on excelling in whatever work we do. You know, slothfulness, if our standard is excellence, slothfulness won't cause us problems. And we will be successful because our attitude is right, and we will learn these lessons God has for us. Matthew 5:24.
In your offering, therefore, before the altar, and go your way, first be reconciled to your brother, and then come and present your offering.
Brethren, bad habits can make it difficult for us to start over. We need to first remove the results of our bad practices in the past. Restitution, whether it's of money, whether it's of goods, whether it's of someone else, is a scriptural element. 1 Timothy 6:6-7.
But godliness with contentment is great gain.
For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out.
Brethren, we need to be content, whatever circumstances we are. Covetousness, greed, overindulgence shouldn't be part of our Christian life. James 4:3.
You ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures.
Brethren, we need to provide for those that are entrusted to us first. Provide for our family. Often it means our personal sacrifice or cutting back. But yet that is the principle that Paul talks about with self-discipline. Proverbs 23, 4 and 5.
Do not weary yourselves to gain wealth. Cease from your consideration of it. When you set your eyes on it, it is gone. For wealth certainly makes itself wings, like an eagle that flies toward the heavens.
We need to keep a balanced commitment. No one on their deathbed has ever said, I wish I'd spent more time at the office. Excessive overtime, a second job we think we need because we need to provide. It's a rationalization, and we're not using the guise of providing a better living, when what we need to do is learn that peace and contentment. Matthew 6:24.
No man can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or despise, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. He cannot serve God and mammon.
Brethren, we need, the big lesson we need is to learn we must sacrifice our own personal desires. The commitments we have should be commitments to the Lord, not to accumulating things of this world. That doesn't mean God expects us to live in poverty. Paul says he learned to abound and to also to suffer need. But God does expect us to live consistent with our principles and not be swayed by the lifestyles which we see going on around us. If we do these things, brethren, we can learn those lessons of being abased.